You're listening to the Bethel Community Church Podcast. Our podcast normally showcases our weekly sermons here in Chicago at 7601 West Foster. Now, podcasts are great, but they do not replace the care and community you receive from the local church or from your local pastor. So we encourage you to come, join our community, or contact us to help you find a community in your area. We pray the Lord speaks to you as you listen. Enjoy.
Theologist Jeffrey Gorer observed that in the 19th century, so that would have been the century before, that sex was taboo, but everybody talked openly about death, because death was very common with high infant mortality rates, with people dying from diseases that today we might even be able to cure, or people dying at home, they would see loved ones regularly dying, and so they talked openly about death. But in the 20th century, things flipped. People now talk openly about sex, and the topic of death has become taboo. Well, if Jeffrey was still alive today, I'm sure that he would notice that we talk far more openly about sex today than we ever did in the 1950s. And we talk far less about death. Today we try to put death off, or we try to leave it to professionals, whether it be hospitals or nursing facilities. And of course, there are times when you just need them. But if we use such resources to try to escape death, to escape the reality of death, we will find ourselves unprepared for it. And we do live in an escapist culture. We live in a society that lives in a fantasy world, a pretend world, in which we try to escape the realities of disease and the realities of hardship and death. David Gibson, in his book Living Life Backward, tells us Ecclesiastes won't let us go there. He says the book of Ecclesiastes is one of God's gifts to help us live in the real world. It's a book in the Bible that gets under the radar of our thinking and acts like an incendiary device that is a bomb to explode our make-believe games and jolt us into realizing that everything is not as clean and tidy as the let's pretend world suggests. So Gibson says we are to instead live life backwards. We are to live life in light of death, which is what Ecclesiastes calls us to do. My main idea is, we're going to look at Ecclesiastes 7, 1 through 14 in just a moment, is that since God providentially governs all of life, live with death always in view, rather than living for diversions or in cynicism. Now, in these 14 verses, it is a series of proverbs that he gives us, that he connects them all together, and we shouldn't be surprised. Ecclesiastes 12, the end of the book, in verses 9 through 10, we're told, besides being wise, the preacher, in Hebrew it's Koheleth, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. Now, wisdom cannot save you from death. Wisdom doesn't even take away how life is hebel in Hebrew. That is, how life is full of emptiness. It's brief. It's often absurd. But wisdom, as we'll see today, is a better way to live. He'll use that word better or good throughout the passage to show us the way that we should live, because there's only one other way besides wisdom to live. It'd be to live in folly. Living in wisdom, then, allows us to enjoy life even as we face hardships, even as we face suffering and uncertainty, even when life doesn't go our way. We can enjoy life in this real world if we live our lives in light of death. So he's going to give us two better ways to live. The first is found in verses 1 through 6, where we see it's better to live in light of death than amusing yourself to death. Look with me at verse 1. It says, "A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. It's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It's better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fools. This also is vanity." The 18th century American pastor Jonathan Edwards, who was probably most famous for his revival sermon, "Sinners in the Hands of the Angry God," was also well known for having resolutions for himself. In fact, he had 70 resolutions. Keep that in mind when you can't keep one at the beginning of the year. One of the best known resolutions is resolution number 9. There, Edwards says, "Resolve to think much on all occasions of my own dying and of the common circumstances which attend death." It may sound like Jonathan Edwards was being morbid, but he really wasn't. No, living in light of death in those days, as the Puritans often sought to do, was commonly called, and this is a Latin word, so excuse me if I mispronounce it, "memento mori." It means something like remembering that you are going to die. And so you were to live life in light of your coming death because it sobered you up so that you could live for what truly mattered. That's what Ecclesiastes is calling us to do here in these first 6 verses, to live in light of your own mortality so that you can live wisely, so that you can live a better life. What Koheleth says here in these 6 verses is meant to shock us. And so we're going to take these 6 together, the other Proverbs. They're meant within context to teach us how to live. And in the first verse, he probably has another proverb in mind. Proverbs 22, verse 1, that says, "A good name or a good reputation is to be chosen rather than great riches." But in Ecclesiastes, he says it as a pun. He says, "A good name," which in Hebrew, the word name is shem. "A good shem is better than good shemen," ointment or oil. See, it's better to have a good name, a good reputation, than it is to enjoy the good things of life. And yet his point here isn't to leave us with that. That's a well-known fact in those days. Rather, what he's saying is, just as it's better to have a good name, so it's better the day of death than the day of birth. Think about that for a moment, what he's saying. He goes on, verse 2, then to say, it's better to go to the house of mourning than it is a house of feasting. It's better to go to a funeral than it is to a party. You might be listening to him and thinking, well, wait a second, this guy is disturbed. And this is pretty dark. What on earth is he getting at? Well, no, I don't think he is. He tells us why, at the end of verse 2. Because this is the end of all mankind. Nobody escapes death. And while you're living, you'll be wise to take that to heart, to live in light of it. It continues, verse 3, sorrow, or it could be translated as grief or anger, is better than laughter. There you go, watch dramas instead of comedies. Well, no, that's not quite what he's saying. Rather, what he's saying is that if we live in the real world, we'll see that there's so much going on that rightly grieves our hearts, that angers us. And so we have to think rightly about the world that we live in. And if we do, then we can have gladness of heart. Why? Because we'll enjoy the very things that God gives us rather than thinking that we're entitled to them. It's better, as he says, to regularly visit the house of mourning, that is to think about death, than it is to be celebrating. Well, why? Because nobody learns wisdom at a party. You learn it from considering death. It's better to be rebuked by somebody wise, as he says, than it is to join in the song of fools. Why? Because it's short-lived. Verse 6, he says, it's like the crackling of thorns under a pot that are being used as fuel for a fire. Now, thorns don't make good fuel. When you burn them, they make a lot of noises. They pop, but they don't last long. They don't burn long, because they're quickly consumed. He's saying, so it is with the laughter of fools. It's short-lived. It may be loud and boisterous, but it doesn't last very long. As he says, it's vanity, it's hebel, it's empty and short-lived. Now, we are to live, he's saying, in light of the end, in light of death, or as David Gibson puts it, we're to live life backward. You see, if you know where you're going, you can plot your course on the map. You can decide which route you're going to take to get there, and we are all on a journey that has the same end. It's death. You don't get to decide the end of the journey, but you do get to choose which path you take to get there. Death is inevitable. Reality is, it could be today. For any one of us, could be 70 years from now. We don't get to determine when death will take us. All that we get to determine is how we get there. Unfortunately, many Christians, and I can say I find myself here often, we don't live in light of death. No, we're constantly distracted with worldly amusements, aren't we? Some years ago, I read Neil Postman's famous book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. It was originally published in 1985. And so that was over 40 years ago. Well, Postman argued at that time that technology, especially the television, was degrading our society so that we're becoming shallow by all of these amusements. It was undermining our ability to think critically and to live wisely. You know, I think if Postman were around to see today, he died in 2003, if Postman was still around and saw the effects of smartphones and video games and social media, I think Neil Postman would have said, look, you've proven me completely right. Binging on Netflix or watching endless TikTok videos or continually reading inane X, that is Twitter, posts makes us so that we're like distracted drivers. What happens when you get distracted when you're driving? It's not long before you find yourself crashing. As Christians, we must learn to live with death in view because it sobers us up. It's not so that we'll be morbid and not enjoy life. No, it's so that we actually enjoy life as God gives it to us. Amusing ourselves to death, as he says, is hebel. It's vanity. It's empty. Instead, we ought to be people who pray along with Moses in Psalm 90, verse 12. Teach us, Lord, to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. Teach us to live in light of the coming reality of death so that we may learn to live wisely today. It's good, if you're a Christian, to sometimes slow down and to just do that very thing. How can you do it? Well, look at your life. Everything in life, in some way, is pointing you to the reality that death is coming. Bobby Jameson, in his book on Ecclesiastes, insightfully writes, "You are made from earth dust. One day, the dust that used to be you will disperse upon the earth. The dead skin cells that your body sheds become a small portion of the dust that settles on every surface of your home. So the next time you spray a shelf and wipe it down, consider it a preview. That's a very little bit of you. Soon it will be all of you." So we're being told it's better to live in light of death than amusing ourselves to death, because this is how we live wisely. Second, in verses 7 through 10, then he teaches us it's better to patiently wait for the outcome than to fall into cynicism. Verse 7, he says, "Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the hearts of fools. Say not, 'Why were the former days better than these?' For it's not from wisdom that you ask this." This transition here from talking about death to saying that we shouldn't become angry or bitter or cynical, it seems like a kind of strange transition on the surface of it. But really what he's saying is we're to be living in light of the end, in light of the outcome of things. And so rather than growing frustrated when you don't get your way, rather than being upset when things in life don't happen as you think they should happen, instead, you're to be patient. You're to wait to see the outcome. Verse 7, he again talks about oppression, which we've seen he's done before. But here he says that oppression can drive those who are wise into madness, that is, into foolishness. So seeing oppression or experiencing injustice against yourself can make a wise person start to live like a fool. Why? Because the wise person isn't drowning out the realities of life with amusements and entertainments or with a bottle or with drugs or whatever. And so the wise person sees reality, lives in reality. But the problem is, you can quickly become cynical. A wise person may think, you know what, if I can't beat them, I might as well join them. And again, that's a form of cynicism. But if you become a cynic, it's not long before you give in to the temptation and you think, okay, well, if everybody else is doing it, I guess, as he says, I'll take a bribe. A bribe corrupts the heart. It corrupts the way you think, the way you, what you desire. And so what do you need to do? You've got to guard your heart against becoming bitter and cynical. Proverbs 4:23 wisely says, keep your heart with all vigilance. Why? Because from your heart flow the springs of life. So you've got to guard your heart. You've got to be careful to do so that you don't fall into this sort of bitter, cynical, angry thinking. And this is true whether you're young or whether you're old or anywhere in between. We've got to live life backward. That is in light of the coming, in light of the outcome. As he goes on to say, verse 8, it's the end of a thing is better than its beginning. The outcome is better. And so he's calling us then to be patient in spirit. Literally what he says is it's better to have length of spirit than to have height of spirit, to be proud. It's better to be long-suffering, to wait for the outcome. Because life isn't going to always go your way. If you're idealistic, you might become discouraged or even disoriented, become unsettled by what you experience or see in life. And in pride, you might think, well, I wouldn't do it that way. In pride, you might wonder, why is God letting this even happen? He's telling us not to turn there. Life isn't always going to go our way, so we need to be careful how we process things. Verse 9, don't be quick in your spirit to become angry, to become bitter and cynical. Why? Because anger lodges in the heart of fools. Literally, it lodges in the lap or the bosom of fools. You see, if you stew in anger over injustices, whether they're toward you or others, that anger will eventually turn to bitterness. And that bitterness then will become a cynicism in which that's the lens through which you will see all of life. You might look at the world and think people are getting away with it, but his point is nobody ever does. You go to the end of the book, Chapter 12, verse 14, and he says, God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. That is the ultimate outcome. And so we are to live in light of death in the coming judgment. Otherwise, you'll look at the world with the sort of eyes of nostalgia, verse 10, and say, why were the former days better than these? Whatever happened to the good old days? The problem is when we look at the world through the eyes of nostalgia and think things used to be so much better than they are now, we tend to forget all the bad things, all the hard things from the past, and we tend to overlook the good things today. And Christians and churches can end up here. But it's like driving 70 miles per hour down the freeway and looking out the back window because you like the scenery back there and thinking, oh man, I want to see that again. And so you're stuck staring at it while you're speeding down the highway. Well, what are you going to do? You're going to crash. So what do you need to do? You need to look forward. You need to keep your eyes on the end, where you're going. That will keep you from falling into despair or cynicism. So he tells us it's better to live in light of death than amusing yourself to death. And it's better to patiently wait for God than it is to fall into cynicism. Well, then he gives us two reasons why. First, in verses 11 and 12, he says, wisdom is good with an inheritance. That's why wisdom is better. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. Why? Because the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money. The advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Notice there's an advantage to having wisdom. It provides protection for life under the sun. Now, wisdom, as we've seen before in Ecclesiastes, is not the ultimate solution to death. You can have all the wisdom in the world and you will not escape death. Likewise, it's not the escape from the hell of life, all the absurdities and emptiness. And yet wisdom isn't bad. As he says, wisdom is good. It's relatively better than the alternative, which is foolishness. You should always choose the better path, is what he's saying. Wisdom with an inheritance is an advantage. You might say, well, why does he say with an inheritance? Well, you see, under the old covenant, Israel had the land of Canaan as their inheritance. And so every tribe got a lot, every clan, every family got their own lot, their own portion, and every family needed that inheritance to survive. Without your inheritance, your family name would be lost. And so you needed that inheritance, and he's saying in the same way you need wisdom. Wisdom will survive. It's an advantage as you go through life under the sun. The Hebrew word here for advantage is the same Hebrew word of the word, root of the word gain. Remember back in chapter 1, verse 3, he said, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? And the point was, he gains nothing. There's no ultimate gain in life because you're going to die and you can't take anything with you. But there is a relative advantage to wisdom rather than folly. Why? Because wisdom can protect you. Literally, he says, wisdom is a shade, much like money provides shade for life under the sun, much like a cloud or a tree provides shade from the blazing desert sun. Now, money does have an advantage to it over being in poverty. Money isn't an ultimate gain. We saw that last week. Money can't satisfy you. Money won't give you control in life. But it is better to have some money than not. You know, in those days, if your crops failed, it's better to be able to afford to purchase some food in the famine than it is to starve to death. Likewise, today, if you have money, you can buy locks on your doors, or you can buy software to protect your computer against hackers. So wisdom, like money, is relatively better. It can preserve your life if you have it. And just think about it in everyday life. If you have enough wisdom and knowledge, you know you don't go down the dark alley at night because somebody could be lurking there. Well, how do you know that? Because you have enough wisdom not to do that. Wisdom spared your life. But more than that, what he's saying is that wisdom and knowledge can keep you from trying to live your life apart from God. So there is an advantage to wisdom. It protects you for life under the sun. In verses 13 and 14, he says, consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful, and in the day of adversity, consider God has made the one, that is the day of prosperity, as well as the other, that is the day of adversity. God made them both, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. Notice the reality here of life. Wisdom considers you cannot change God's providence. You can't make God change what God is going to do because he is God. This actually takes us back to chapter 6, verses 10 through 12, which is a transitional passage. There he says, whatever has come to be has already been named, and it's known what man is, and that he's not able to dispute with one stronger than he, that is, with God. The more words, the more vanity. What is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? You know, God is infinitely stronger than us. We can't argue with God or dispute with him to get our way. Now, he's the potter. We are the clay. We have no right to try to tell God what he ought to do or make demands of him. He's God. And we can't change his providential decrees. No, God, by his absolute wisdom, his complete goodness, his love, God is governing the universe the way that he knows is best. So what do we need to do? We need to consider the work of God. If God made something crooked, we're not going to make it straight. You see, we can't change the laws of physics even. We can't make a man a woman or a woman a man, no matter how much technology we have. Why? Because the structures of creation don't bend to our wills and whims. God is God. He created the world as it is, and it's the same for his providential care. God governs things in the way he knows is ultimately best, because think about it, none of us sees the whole picture of our own lives, let alone the whole picture of the universe or human history. Understanding this changes how you and I live. In the day of prosperity, when things are going well, what should you do? Enjoy it. Enjoy what God gives you. Enjoy the food and the drink he gives you. Enjoy the toil, the work that he gives you, the things in life that are enjoyable. And when adversity comes, literally when evil or bad days come, what are you to do? When you face times of suffering and sorrow, when you face death, when life is hard and it doesn't go your way, what should you do? You should consider. God is the one who gives both good days and hard days. And yet we can't figure out what tomorrow is going to bring. At best, we're like the weatherman trying to look at things and figure it out. How often do they get it wrong? We don't know what tomorrow will bring, let alone we can't control it. But if you know the God who is good and always faithful as your loving Father, you don't have to control the future. You don't have to know what it's going to bring. You can trust him. And that will give you peace. The peace of God that surpasses understanding, no matter what circumstances of life may bring you. So consider God's providence. Consider, though, that God has told us what is ultimately coming in his word. Death is coming in judgment, and none of us can escape that. There's an old fable of a merchant in Baghdad, Iraq, who sent his servant into the market. Well, the servant came back very quickly, and he was white with fear and trembling and said to his master, "Master, in the market I was jostled by a woman in the crowd. And when I looked behind me to see this woman, I saw it was death. And death made a terrifying gesture at me. Please, master, lend me your fastest horse that I may ride away to Samarra and escape death." Well, the master lent his servant his fastest horse, and so he hastily galloped away to Samarra. And meanwhile, the master went down to the market and found that death was still there. And so he asked, "Why did you so terrify my servant? Why did you make a threatening gesture at him?" Death replied, "Well, that wasn't a threatening gesture that I made. I was surprised to see him in Baghdad because I have an appointment with him tonight in Samarra." Recognizing that you have an inescapable date with death should sober you up. God has appointed for us to die once. We only get one take at life under the sun. And then comes the judgment. Are you prepared for death? Are you prepared for the judgment? It's wisdom that points us beyond itself to the one who is wisdom in the flesh. As Colossians 2:3 says, in Jesus Christ are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. He alone is the wisdom that overcomes the Hebel of life and who can overcome death. You see, if you're acting like you're not going to die, you can't escape the reality. If you're acting like you're not going to be judged, it doesn't matter. You cannot escape the reality. Living life in light of death begins by asking, have my sins been forgiven? Have I been reconciled to the holy God who is going to be my judge? Then in wisdom, you look to the one who alone died on the cross so that our sins might be forgiven through his taking our sins in his own flesh. You look to the one who alone has overcome death. As Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. And then he asks the question, do you believe this? If you're trusting in Jesus Christ this morning as your Lord and Savior, living in light of death and judgment isn't just about escaping hell. No, it's about how we live today. If you live in light of death and the coming judgment, it can help you to keep from stumbling into sin. It fuels repenting of your sins and forsaking them and instead walking in purity and in holiness and in love for our neighbors. Because 2 Corinthians 5:10 says, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ so that each of us may receive what is due for what we have done in the body, whether good or evil. So as Christians, we would be wise to join Jonathan Edwards and to resolve to think much on all occasions of my own dying. Why? Because God is providentially governing all of life. So we are to live with death always in view, rather than living for the diversions or in the cynicism that so marks our age.